Listeners, if you like MPFI's neurotransmissions, you do not want to miss the chance to join us live for Sunposium. It's happening March 4th through 6th in beautiful West Palm Beach, Florida. This is a two-day conference. It brings the best minds in neuroscience. We're going to have poster sessions. We're going to have great talks. And if you want, you could even meet us, the podcast team. We are now accepting calls for abstracts. And if we really like your abstract, you will have the opportunity to speak at Sunposium along with the greats. So learn more at sunposium.org. So that's sunposium.org.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Max Planck Florida's Neurotransmissions Podcast. I'm Joe Schumacher, and I'm joined again by my co-host, Ben Scholl. Ben, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. It's been a while, but I'm back.
Yeah, actually, the listeners won't know that it's been a while because you've been on, you know, all the episodes that are coming out. But It actually has been a while since you've been in the booth, so to speak.
So for them, it's fresh.
Yeah, so okay. Where have you been this whole time?
So nothing happened.
Yeah. so we've got another interesting show today. It's sort of in our series of, exciting seminal work in the visual system and the history of visual neuroscience in general. Previous episodes have featured Tony Movshin, David Furster, Judith Hirsch.
Yeah.
Lots of great vision scientists.
And
many more. So what do we have today?
So today we have Dr. Michael Stryker, who's a giant in the field. He has continued a strong visual research in a variety of different species for decades. I mean, he's produced numbers of graduate students who've gone on to start their own labs. He's actually been a professor at the UCSF, University of California in San Francisco, for his entire career, which is actually pretty interesting too. And so looking forward to hearing about his career path and the kinds of studies that he does in the lab.
Yeah, today. I mean, he had an interesting life before neuroscience too, so hopefully we'll hear a bit about that. Let's see what he has to say. So joining us today is Dr. Michael Stryker. He's the W.F. Ganong Endowed Chair of Physiology at UCSF. He is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the National Academy of Sciences. Dr. Stryker, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You have a very distinguished career in visual neuroscience in particular. We actually thought we might start out prior to you becoming a neuroscientist. So I've seen from your bio sketch that you were a hydraulics engineer in the Peace Corps after college.
Yes.
Yeah. So what was that transition like? What did you study as an undergrad? What brought you into the Peace Corps, and how did you sort of become a neuroscientist?
Yeah, I think it's kind of an interesting story, and I'm sure stories like this apply to a lot of people. That I went to college abandoning the idea of being a poet my first semester because I had a good literature teacher who saved the world from a lot of terrible poetry. But thinking I was going to be a mathematician. And by the beginning of my junior year in college, I was in a program. The University of Michigan has a very good math program, and this Hungarian mathematician whom I studied with. And I came to realize that real mathematicians were like musical prodigies or something. They weren't just good at math, they were qualitatively different. And in my year at Michigan, I think there were six of us in the honors math program, and I never finished more than 30% of an exam that was given. And I thought they might kick me out, actually. So that convinced me I shouldn't be a mathematician, but I was also kind of interested in philosophy. And foundations in mathematics is is a kind of philosophy. So I said, okay, I'll be a philosophy major. And I was, but I also needed money. So the highest paying job you could get as an undergraduate at Michigan was cleaning rat cages in a brain research lab. And the lab happened to be the lab of Jim Olds, who discovered self-stimulation and pleasure centers in the brain. And I was, you know, it was the early days of computers. And I had spent a summer programming computers. I was also a surveyor. My father had been a civil engineer and taught me to survey. So I had put in water systems in the American West. So that was my hydraulics experience. But I got this job cleaning rat cages, and after a while persuaded them to let me program these computers, which had 4K of memory and had to be programmed in assembly code. And I got to know Jim Olds very well. So even though in the end my degree was mathematics and philosophy, with a philosophy honors thesis that the philosophy faculty hated, because it said that a lot of things that the philosophers thought were their problems were really problems about how the mind worked and not problems about the outside world. And the right way to study them was to actually do science on the mind.
They didn't like the reductionist approach.
Oh, the philosophers thought this was awful. But so I knew I couldn't go on in philosophy. And I'd been in school all my life. So, and I'd always, all my life, been really interested in East Africa, in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. So I had applied to the Peace Corps to go work in East Africa. And at that time, shortly after independence, there were only four graduate engineers from the three East African countries. And so most of the engineering was done by either American Peace Corps volunteers, by some Dutch volunteers, some Swedish volunteers, and some British contract engineers. So it was just great. It was very exciting living in East Africa, designing things, surveying, building pipelines with volunteer labor from the farmers whose places we were supplying with water. But after about a year and a half, even though it was an exciting life and I thought about doing other things, I wrote my brother, little brother, and had him send me some books about neuroscience. And I read them and applied to graduate school from East Africa, and didn't get into my first choice, so graduate program. So I was left to decide between Caltech, where Jim Olds had moved, and MIT, which probably accepted me because Caltech had accepted me. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, you know, I was just very lucky. For not very good reasons, I decided to go to MIT. And had this fantastic PhD advisor, Peter Schiller, who was another Hungarian, very rigorous, who was a terrific mentor. He didn't approve of the thing I did my thesis on, but he let me do it anyway, which was really good.
And he let you graduate.
What I worked on ended up being very, very controversial, and I was pleased that when I was attacked at the thesis defense, he defended me. I almost didn't have to say anything, actually. But even though it wasn't a project that he thought I should have done, so I was very lucky.
So what was the controversial finding?
So the controversial finding was came from these really intriguing experiments that are unfortunately still in many psychology books, though they're wrong, that Colin Blakemore and the group that Horace Barlow and Blakemore and Pettigrew had at Berkeley at that time, and then later at Cambridge, had published these experiments showing whose thesis was that there was no innate specificity of, say, for orientation selectivity, and that orientation selectivity developed as a result of visual experience. And My thesis was an attempt to extend those findings by showing that you could tune up orientation selectivity on the table in an anesthetized animal, and it didn't work. And so I took a step backwards, and I ended up taking two steps backwards and trying to reproduce those original findings, which I could never reproduce. Mm. And then we also studied visually inexperienced animals, animals that had been born and raised in the dark until the beginning of the critical period. And the very first neuron I ever recorded from such an animal, like the other neurons, was perfectly selective for orientation. So the basic story and why it was interesting, turned out not to be true. And then we later collaborated, while I was still a graduate student, with Helmut Hirsch, who had raised animals in a way that really restricted their experience with orientation. And what we saw is that the cells that had never been given appropriate experience became unresponsive or non-selective. But it wasn't that the brain develops according to what you see, it's that it develops normally in the dark without experience, and then if it doesn't receive appropriate experience, it falls apart. Mm. So the role of experience was preserving and slightly enhancing response. But this was a big European-American controversy because the Brits all were for Colin Blakemore's results, and we were on the other side, and there was a lot of tension, a lot of news coverage. And, and I was also very lucky that my mentors and the people in my department at MIT stood by me and stood by the data, even when, we had done some experiments where the British group raised the animals and we studied them.
Really?
And part of the reason our results were more accurate, it was MIT, right? So we made what was the world's first computer-driven optical display that could present randomly interleaved stimuli mm-hmm. and measure the responses quantitatively. we anatomically reconstructed our penetrations because the visual cortex is arranged in columns that if the first neuron you hit has a particular selectivity, the other neurons will be similar. So we made sure that our measurements were from penetrations, were cutting across columns. And all of those things make it, made our measurements much more credible than the conflicting ones. Mm. But, it was a funny story. But my advisor actually, he never believed the earlier reports that my thesis was trying to extend. So he told me I was wasting my time trying to extend this, but he still let me do it. And so that is a great lesson for PhD advisors, is advise, but don't step on your students and
right.
control them.
Because even if they start out trying to extend something, they might go on to just disprove it or something.
Yeah, so the first paper I wrote on my own, I had written a couple of papers on his research program working with him, but the very first paper I wrote on my own, I sort of worked on that for about 6 months doing the experiment and had hardly talked to him during those 6 months. I mean, he let me go off on my own. I wrote the paper to him, took it to him in his office. He was smoking his pipe in the office. In those days, you could still smoke. And, read my paper and crumpled it up and threw it in the trash can and said, "Michael, we don't publish, well, you can't say it on a yeah. podcast, we don't publish a bleep like this from my laboratory." And which I was more than taken aback. And then the next couple of days, I left then, but then the next couple of days, he explained to me all the things that were wrong with my experiment and why he didn't believe the result, and nobody who read the paper should believe the result, and it was, it was bad science. And it turned out he was exactly right, because I redid that experiment properly after getting all the criticism that I wouldn't have listened to if he'd given it to me at the outset, but I did then, and the result was wrong. Yeah. And even though I felt like, so there is something to be said. When you're a student, you can be unreasonably, you really have to do experiments to high standards.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't listen to what high standards are until you've had the experience of someone telling you that you screwed up.
Right, right.
So.
Well, it's hard as scientists to be, or to work with somebody who has high standards, and they don't necessarily want to spend the time to let you know about their high standards, you know, easily or whatever. They just want to say, hey, here are the standards, right? And go figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way, it might have been better if I hadn't spent this 6 or 8 months working on this experiment on my own get the bad news
right,
then.
Yeah, exactly.
But actually, I think it was a really good lesson that, it's what
important.
You've done at the end that matters. You don't need to be guided day by day. So
right. That's sort of interesting tangentially. I'm just curious, given your experience as a graduate student then, how do you think the experience of graduate students now compares, or maybe how do you think that sort of experience has influenced your own lab as you've trained many different students throughout this time?
Maybe I've been lucky enough not to have students who are as cocky as I was, but I think the atmosphere is really different. First, I think it would be seen as a form of abuse to say to a student what Peter Schiller said to me then, now. So I have been more gentle with my students, and I think in the end you want to have the high standards, but you can relax them somewhat. If you know a student isn't going to go on in science, as some students don't, then you don't feel so bad about relaxing them.
Right.
But I think the atmosphere is really different. And I think students get more care taken for them than they do now. It's less sink or swim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it still is sink or swim in programs like physics and chemistry. But now the graduate programs in biological sciences and neuroscience, pretty much everybody who comes in can finish. And I think it used to be less so.
Sure.
And I don't know what's better. I mean, you know, my advisor, very few of the women students could succeed in his lab because they felt, because of his abrupt attitude, they felt he didn't, even if he had enormous respect for them, and I knew that he had respect for them because he and I became very good friends later, and they had respect for him, somehow that this sort of rough attitude didn't work with a population of very talented students, and it's too bad because they could benefit from each other. So,
sure.
So I think, you know, they're different personal styles and so on, but I think institutionally the programs have become much more supportive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing,
I just wonder, because it just seems like it's a lot more taxing or a lot more effort to be more caring or have a soft demeanor while also having cutting criticism. Because in some ways, it's when you read something or you're involved with a project, you may have some criticism, but then you would just want to like say, oh, here are some things that I think you should think about. But instead, you have to then stop and sort of think, okay, dismantle that criticism into, you know, piecemeal compartments and then deliver them over a certain way or something, which then it just seems like it's a lot. I don't know. It just seems interesting that it's.
Yeah, I think it's a great point you're emphasizing. And I think you can only be thoroughly honest and thoroughly critical with people that you have high respect for. So if you respect people a lot, you can be absolutely devastating in your criticism because, you know, you don't have to filter your thoughts and your criticisms. And, you know, I've had experience with one graduate student who was not from my lab, but from one of my colleagues' labs, whom I just thought was amazing, just terrific. And for her first paper, I guess, she showed it to me and stuff. And I was as critical of it as I would have been if her mentor had shown it to me. Right. And I only learned later that that was in some ways a really cruel thing to do, because I thought she knew how much I respected her. But in fact, her advisor told me later that she almost didn't come in for 2 weeks and was crying and was, you know, and thought that, you know, so I think in retrospect, I might have been more gentle. But I was only so critical because I just thought she was terrific.
Right.
And you know, nothing I could possibly say critical could take away from my admiration for her and for her work.
Right.
So these things can go either way.
Yeah.
And one should be sensitive, I suppose. But I think the people who are going to succeed in science, a lot of things one does never work. You need to have a certain resilience.
And I think sometimes those lessons get sort of taken in over longer time scales. Like you realize maybe a year later, you're reminded of something, some criticism somebody gave you at one point, and you're like, oh, they must have been telling me that to prepare me for, you know, when I was getting this paper reviewed, and I got the exact same criticism or something. Yeah. So.
Well, I might be harsher than the reviewers.
Yeah.
I mean, this young woman and I talked about this some years later. Yeah. And, you know, she felt it was probably a good thing.
I realized that, too. I think it took like 3 or 4 years for me in my graduate program. But I realized that the extent of the criticism that I got from my advisor was directly due to how much respect we had for each other, and how that he just wanted the paper, the work, to be of the highest caliber, the highest quality, you know. And so... Yeah, but it was exactly the same situation as you. It's like you spend 6 months working on the experiment, you write the thing, you're like, I'm super proud of it, and it gets destroyed, and you're like, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
But speaking of trainees and trainers and, you know, mentors, after your PhD, you went and did a postdoc with Hupel and Wiesel.
Right.
And so you stayed in the vision field, and you would continue to stay in the vision field for, you know, till, you know, now even. What was their sort of mentor style like, and what was the project you were working on with them?
Yeah. So my PhD advisor actually had told me I shouldn't do a postdoc, and I was offered some faculty jobs after graduate school. And he said, oh, you can go anywhere and learn any new technique in 6 weeks. But for me, the postdoc years were just enormously important and expanded my horizons. The neurobiology department at Harvard in those days, you know, was like the model for other neurobiology departments that followed, where it had biochemistry and cellular neurophysiology as well as systems. Neuroscience all together, and it was like a big commune in many ways. People ate dinner there together as well as lunch together pretty much every day, all of us. And we dined on, one of the labs studied lobsters, so there were lots of lobster tails in the freezer all the time.
Oh, wow.
You got to hate lobster, but stir-fried lobster, I mean, ugh. It still is not attractive. But I think, you know, what I had discovered in the course of my PhD thesis was that Hubel and Wiesel's original papers were right. And there was a period of time in the early 1970s when everyone said, oh, it's too bad that, you know, they got this big thing wrong about innate versus experience, innate development versus experience-dependent development. But in fact, they were absolutely right on. And I gave a seminar over at Harvard while I was a graduate student, and David and Torsten said, well, would you like to come over here? And I did, and it was, for 2 years, it was one of the most exciting times in my life, where there were 4 or 5 different collaborations on different experiments. But basically what happened then among the postdoc community is there was a 2-year sequence of neuroscience courses taught to the graduate students. And 2 nights a week, the postdoc community met together to use the same curriculum, but without the professors, that the graduate students used. And so I was taught biochemistry, and we taught each other what we didn't know. So I was taught biochemistry by Lou Reichert. I taught Lou and Yunung Jan and Lily Jan about systems neuroscience. And, you know, whereas there were a lot of people who've done great work, Lou, Mary Kennedy, others in the postdoc community. And we met twice a week in the evenings for 2 hours or more, going, you know, all over this vast range of neuroscience. So I didn't know much about, except about vision. I knew vision psychology and vision systems neuroscience, but I didn't know cellular neurophysiology very well, and I didn't know anything about biochemistry and stuff. So the postdoc years really expanded my horizon. And at that time, combining approaches of anatomy and physiology was a new thing. So it was sufficiently new that Carla Schatz and I and Peter Kirkwood were asked to teach a course at Cold Spring Harbor a lab course for 3 summers on techniques for studying the vertebrate central nervous system, so that we ended up teaching a whole bunch of students, including Francis Crick, who was getting interested in the brain at that time. And he took the lecture part of our course the first year. So I think the postdoc years, I think, are really important, because you can be a full-time scientist, and there are very few institutions where assistant professors can be full-time scientists.
Right.
I mean, this place, the Max Planck, is one of them where people can be full-time at science, even at a, you know, after the when they have their independent labs. But mostly you have other things to do, teaching and administration, writing grants and all this stuff, which takes up a very significant fraction of your time and energy. And so you can't be in the lab every moment.
Right.
Whereas a postdoc, you have time to think about what are the important questions, and you have all the time in the world to be in the lab. And it was a very, very valuable time for me. I think vision remained, we just know so much about vision, and vision has a very large community and it's very competitive, so that bad ideas are driven out and good ideas survive in a way that they don't in other fields of neuroscience, where there are authoritative figures who control what's seen as important and so on. So I think some fields were held back for 20 years by the control of the field by senior people. For example, people like Mike Merzenich and John Koss and John Allman and Samir Zeki were driven out of somatic sensation, because somatosensory neurophysiology was held in the dark ages for 20 years by a system that was, you know, where a few powerful figures controlled what got published. Whereas vision, it was more, I mean, the attitude of Hubel and Wiesel toward people doing other things and doing wrong things was just great. Let those chuckleheads do whatever they want. let it be published. They won't mess around with, you know, with the interesting stuff, which is what we're doing.
Right.
So I think vision was a wonderful field, because it had, you know, a lot was known about the brain, a lot was known about behavior, and it was ripe for being studied. And for a long time, it's very hard to control somatosensory stimuli. And auditory stimuli, so much processing goes on in the brainstem that it's hard to separate what goes on in the cortex from what goes on below. So I think vision was a good thing to do, and I never seriously considered switching to another system.
And yeah, I mean, you brought up this idea that, you know, new ideas can sort of come and go in vision neuroscience. You know, one of the areas that you pushed for in your career is the development of sort of new systems for understanding different facets of vision. So what drew you to working on ferrets, for instance? Ben and I work in a ferret lab.
And so, I mean, I've always been interested in the questions. You know, what's the most important question? My office mate Bill Harris and I, when we were postdocs, spent a long, long time thinking about what are the most important things to figure out about development of the visual system. And, you know, we concluded that most of it was the role of neural activity. And Bill went on to study this in salamanders and axolotls and stuff. And I went on to study this using drugs in cats. And it became clear that a lot of interesting stuff was going on early in the development of the visual system. And so I started studying ferrets, and nobody had ever recorded from the visual system of ferrets. But it was known, Ray Guillory's lab had shown that, you know, it was a typical carnivore visual system, at least as far as the broad outlines of the anatomy were. And a ferret was born like a 2.5 week premature cat. So Carla Schatz was doing experiments in fetal cats, and that was hard. And she and I collaborated on some experiments, but it's very hard, you know, a lot of experiments are very hard to do if you have to do them when the animals are in utero. So when I learned how early ferrets were born, I said, well, we can go study the ferret, and then we'll have access to this period in early development, which is very important. And I naively thought, well, probably the ferret's just like the cat. So in 2 years, we can repeat all the important experiments that were ever done in the cat. And that turned out not to be true, of course, because the ferret's not exactly like the cat. And we discovered a lot of interesting things like the on and off sublamination, you know, that the on cells and off cells are segregated in the ferret much more completely at both the early levels and cortical level than they are in other species. And so basically I went to the ferret because I wanted to study the early development of cortical columns and how they were organized. And because it was the question that mattered, mm-hmm. not the animal. And it was kind of fun doing a new animal. We created a new kind of stereotax, you know, new tools for developing it, and we learned new things. And it's surprising. I mean, one of the funny things about the ferret was we knew that there were these anatomical leaflets in the lateral geniculate nucleus, little sublayers. And I was firmly believed that these would turn out to be different classes of ganglion cells going there, like X cells and Y cells, linear cells and nonlinear cells. And so we made recordings in several ferrets, Kathleen Zaz and I, and didn't realize that what we were seeing were separate cells that responded to light on or light off. Mm. Even though it was absolutely there, you know, because we were looking for something else, we failed to notice this until halfway through those experiments. And then we said, oh, how could we not see it? And then, of course, it was all there in the earlier data. So
it just seems to come down to, sometimes it comes down to like the type of question, you know, you chose the ferret to study a universal question. You had a universal question, a global question about neuroscience. How does this, a very ubiquitous question, but then there are also visual neuroscience questions. And I think oftentimes if you start digging down and you get into the visual neuroscience question, you often miss, you can, or you're not necessarily miss, but you can be occluded from other features that might be interesting, or, you know, and, or like this or whatnot. But, no, that's interesting that about the universality is interesting, just because as postdocs, I feel like we spend a lot of time thinking about systems dependent questions, and now spending a lot more time trying to think of what is the big question that we're actually trying to achieve here? Not what is the exact science that we're doing? What is the overarching theme? What is the universal question that it could apply to systems beyond vision or any sensory cortices?
Yeah, no, I think that's, I think that's common to people who, I mean, I think the difference between good scientists and bad scientists is good scientists only work on important questions. And, you know, they may not turn out to be important in the long run, but at least they work on them because they think they're getting an important question. Whereas the idea, you know, why are you studying this? Well, because nobody knows. Well, that's no answer. Nobody knows lots of things.
Right.
But you have to have, I mean, I think it's very good for people to pursue a question that's a general question about how brain function or brain development. And that's why we later turned to the mouse, because the mouse, after molecular genetics and, you know, genetic manipulation technology came along, the mouse was really the only animal in which one could readily do this. And there was a time early on when we were studying the mouse when essentially everybody who was doing systems neuroscience in mice and mutant mice could fit in one small conference room about twice as big as this.
And now it's almost all of systems neuroscience, basically.
What?
Well, now it's currently
in any area of systems neuroscience.
Yeah.
And we all fit in a little conference room at Cold Spring Harbor for some meetings that Alcino Silva organized, and traded our mutants and talked to each other about what was going on. And so it was a great opportunity. And now, you know, mouse neuroscience is almost taken over the whole field, which is unfortunate because there are a lot of things that need other kinds of preparations to be addressed. But for the questions about mechanism, molecular mechanism, the mice are tremendously more convenient than other species. So
yeah, so we have just a little bit more time. It'd be nice to talk a little bit about how you use the mouse.
Yeah.
And what are some of the questions that you're able to explore with it?
So one of the questions that we're really interested in mice is similar to a question that we looked at in many animals beforehand, which is, how is it that neural activity influences the way the brain works? How, you know, and at some global sense, you could say, why aren't you studying learning and memory? Because obviously, you know, what I tell my class, the medical students or the pharmacy students, when I lecture on, you know, learning and memory, I say, you know, I hope at the end of this lecture something is different in your brain in a persistent way, or else this lecture will have had no purpose.
Experience dependent.
But I, you know, and the problem with learning and memory is it's very hard to, with the most studies of learning memories, you don't know where it happens and you don't know exactly how it happens. And I applaud the people who are studying that. But in the visual system, in the visual cortex, we have many kinds of, many phenomena of plasticity whose mechanisms we can dissect. And so I expect that these same kinds of mechanisms will also be responsible for things like learning and memory, although time will tell. But the visual plasticity is interesting in itself, and I think the similarity of different cortical areas suggests that what the cortex does and how it changes as a result of experience will be similar in different areas. And so I hope the things we're learning in the visual cortex will be quite general to cortical function. And I think there are a lot of people who hope this. The Allen Institute is investing major resources studying the visual system as a model for cortical function.
Right, and so you're able to use the mouse basically to dissect out unique cell types and their circuit arrangement and how they participate in these plasticity processes.
And an example is, in the old days, and in most creatures except mice, you can distinguish excitatory cells from inhibitory cells, and people say, the excitatory cells, you know, on average do this, and the inhibitory cells on average do that. But we now know from mice that different classes of inhibitory cells are doing precisely the opposite thing. Hmm. And I think another good example is looking at the striatum, where depending on what experiment people did, it was well known that there were two kinds of pathways in the striatum, the direct pathway and the indirect pathway, and they were differently influenced. They had different effects on movement and were differently affected in Parkinson's disease. But when people studied it, they would see like 60% of the cells did this and 40% did the other thing. And you know, whereas in a different experiment, it might be 60-40 the other way. And it was complete mess. And then essentially from mice, the realization that there were two different kinds of dopamine receptors which distinguished these two classes of cells. And all of a sudden, it was like light shined on the system, and that 100% of the cells were, of the D1 cells were one way, and the D2 cells were different. And so with this molecular technology, one could see specificity, and then the operation of circuits became much clearer. And I think the same thing is true in the visual cortex, looking at the different classes of inhibitory neurons, and as the molecular identification gets better, I think we'll be able to do with this with the different classes of excitatory neurons. So I think it's important that I really feel like, unlike any other time in my career, in the last 5 years, we're actually getting very close to the level at which the brain actually works, of individual synaptic connections that make the neurons fire or keep them from firing. And it's a very, very exciting time. The experiments that I remember teaching undergraduates at MIT in the 1970s, when I was, for a semester, I taught the course while someone was on sabbatical. And the students would say, why don't you just record from all the neurons? Or why don't you just see how this neuron changes from this time to that time? And you say, don't be ridiculous, that's impossible, you know? And now these are things that we can do. And so I think this is really the golden age for neuroscience, and particularly for systems neuroscience, where we can take insights from molecular cell biology and molecular biology and see how they work in the living brain.
So this iterative process of technology development and opening up new questions that can be answered, which, you know, leads to new technology that needs to be developed to answer those questions and stuff. So I think your career, like, pretty beautifully illustrates, you know, how this progress of science in a specific field can take place. So we're just about out of time. So just thank you for sitting down and talking
to us
today.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Enjoy the rest of your time in Florida.
Thank you. I'm in a lovely place.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, and that's our show. Thank you to Dr. Michael Stryker for sitting down and talking to us about his long distinguished career in visual neuroscience.
Fascinating.
It's really cool stuff. And he's always sort of reinventing himself. He's sort of like the Madonna of visual neuroscience. He's always like sort of finding a new cool direction.
You
to
know,
take.
I haven't heard that analogy, but I have to say it's very apt.
Yeah,
it's perfect.
I when in grad school, when I would see a paper that had Michael Stryker like in the author line, I was always thinking like it's a perfect name for like a hard-boiled detective novel, like Michael Stryker.
He solves the visual cortex again.
Yeah, he's back on the streets. but yeah, it was a really great conversation. And you know, definitely stay tuned for more great episodes of the podcast. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at NeuroPodcast. I'm at JW Science. Ben is not on Twitter. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks to the producers in the Office of Scientific Communication, too. Bye.
Bye.